A Tour of the Prairies, Chapter 1. In the often vaunted regions of the far west, several hundred miles beyond the Mississippi, extends a vast tract of uninhabited country where there is neither to be seen the log house of the white man nor the wigwam of the Indian. It consists of great grassy plains interspersed with forests and groves and clumps of trees and watered by the Arkansas, the Grand Canadian, the Red River, and their tributary systems. Over these fertile and verdant wastes still roam the elk, the buffalo, and the wild horse in all their native freedom. These, in fact, are the hunting grounds of the various tribes of the Far West. Hither repair the Osage, the Creek, the Delaware, and other tribes that have linked themselves with civilization and live within the vicinity of the white settlements. Here resort also the Pawnees, the Comanches, and other fierce and as yet independent tribes, the nomads of the prairies, or the inhabitants of the skirts of the Rocky Mountains. These regions I have mentioned form a debatable ground of these warring and vindictive tribes. None of them presume to erect a permanent habitation within its borders. Their hunters and braves repair thither in numerous bodies during the season of game, throw up their transient hunting camps consisting of light bowers covered with bark and skins, commit sad havoc among the innumerable herds that graze the prairies, and, having loaded themselves with venison and buffalo meat, warily retire from the dangerous neighborhood. These expeditions partake always of a warlike character. The hunters are all armed for action, offensive and defensive, moldering skulls and skeletons bleaching in some dark ravine or near the traces of a hunting camp, occasionally mark the scene of a foregone act of blood, and let the wanderer know the dangerous nature of the region he is traversing. It is the purport of the following pages to narrate a month's excursion to these noted hunting grounds through a tract of the country which had not as yet been explored by white men. It was early in October 1832 that I arrived at Fort Gibson, the frontier post of the Far West, situated on the Neosho, or Grand River, near its confluence with the Arkansas. I'd been traveling for a month past with a small party from St. Louis, up the banks of the Missouri and along the frontier line of agencies and missions that extends from the Missouri to the Arkansas. Our party was headed by one of the commissioners appointed by the government of the United States to superintend the settlement of Indian tribes migrating from the east to the west of the Mississippi. In the discharge of his duties, he was thus visiting the various outposts of civilization. And let me here bear testimony to the merits of this worthy leader of our little band. He was a native of one of the towns of Connecticut, a man in whom a course of legal practice and political life had not been able to vitiate an innate simplicity and benevolence of heart. The greater part of his days had been passed in the bosom of his family and the society of deacons, elders, and selectmen on the peaceful banks of the Connecticut, when suddenly he had been called to mount his steed, shoulder his rifle, and mingle among stark hunters, backwoodsmen, and naked savages on the trackless wilds of the Far West. Another of my fellow travelers was Mr. L., an Englishman by birth, but descended from a foreign stock, and who had all the buoyancy and accommodating spirit of a native of the continent. Having rambled over many countries, he had become to a certain degree a citizen of the world, easily adapting himself to any change. He was a man of 1,000 occupations, a botanist, a geologist, a hunter of beetles and butterflies, a musical amateur, a sketcher of no mean pretensions, in short, a complete virtuoso. Added to which, he was a very indefatigable, if not always very successful, sportsman. Never had a man more irons in the fire, and consequently, never was a man more busy nor more cheerful. My third fellow traveler was one who had accompanied the former from Europe and traveled with him as his Timelicus, being apt, like his prototype, to give occasional perplexity and disquiet to his mentor. It was a young Swiss count,